Okay, folks, you are listening to another super edition. I say that because I'm so proud of it, of Planet Porky, the podcast. And, of course, it wouldn't be the same without the wonderful rocket chick extraordinaire Leslie Ann Jones, who's with me now. We're self-isolating again, Leslie Ann. We're in our independent studios, obeying all the rules, and still managing to knock out what I hope you'll agree with me is a fun old chat.
We're doing okay, aren't we? Mm. I'm quite enjoying this. Yes. Will we ever go back to a studio? That's the question.
It's a very good question. I don't know, because due to your industrious work on acquiring the right technology and upgrading the stuff we've got, I'm told by the experts who obviously get hold of this recording after we've finished and then they tech op it and they edit it and they bookend it, put it together, they say that the audio quality is great. I don't think it can ever be as good as a studio, but I'm told it's about 95, 96% there. And it'll be a long time before anybody gets me in a studio because of the fear of travelling there and the fact that studios attract germs. So for the moment, I'm very happy in my one-man studio here at Porky Towers.
Yeah, indeed. Although, you know, we miss the camaraderie, don't we? Yes. We miss the banter. It's much easier to do this face-to-face in the same studio, but we're doing our best. And we have to bear in mind that everybody listening is by themselves somewhere, knuckled down, hold down, and, you know, this is the service we bring to the nation.
Yeah, it certainly is indeed. Talking about the way people interact in this lockdown, I'm already bored stiff with Zoom. I don't know about you, but I find it.
Oh yeah.
I find it rather. Well, I did one with my family, a week ago, and I've done another one with somebody else since. And I think they're embarrassing because you're up there and you're looking at each other's faces. You've got to think of things to say. I find a phone call much, much better.
Although I'm sort of out of the habit of speaking to people on the phone, I don't know about you, but, nowadays it's so easy to text, to email, you can respond in your own time. I tend to go to bed at night and scroll through my texts and my emails and answer them then. Mm. So you can do that, at your leisure. Mm. Phone calls, you almost have to make an appointment with people now to talk to them.
I do. If I call you, I don't know if you've noticed, I usually send you a text and tell you what I'm going to call you. There's a mate I work with and I speak to him every other day and we just text each other and say what time tomorrow because we both get up early and it'll be 7 if we're both clear or it'll be 9 if he's got a job on or I've got a job on. And you're absolutely right. That's the easiest way to do it. I used to have a colleague years ago who was a bit of a slimy individual and whenever he rang and you answered your phone, he'd always say, "Have I caught you at a bad time?" And you think you're about to deliver some new, some really bad news, you know what I mean? But he tried to be terribly charming about it. But I agree with you. The only phone calls that really work are like a catch up with the family, you know what I mean? But but if I just want to say to somebody, studio booked for 2:30 Thursday, all okay, all I want is a quick reply saying, thumbs up and it's the quickest way of doing it. When phones first came out, I used to berate people who messaged because I thought they were trying to hide from me. You know what I mean? Oh, I won't face me on the phone and all that. But, of course, they were just smarter than me. When contactless money first came out, Leslie Ann, I used to go into the pub after work with some young producers and assistant producers, you know what I mean? And I used to feel sorry for them because they were always paying with a card. And I thought, these poor people don't get paid enough to be able to buy a round of drinks. So I bought all the drinks because I thought they were poverty-stricken. In fact, they weren't, they didn't get paid as much as me, but they got onto contactless payments a lot sooner than me.
Well, we even have contactless in church now. So you can make your contribution. The plate doesn't go round anymore.
Right. Yeah.
You make your contribution with your card and it's just the contactless. Mm. Do you want to give £5, £10, £20? And it's as instant as putting a fiver in a plate.
Yeah, sure it is.
So the church had to come into the 21st century like everybody else.
That's right. So is HMRC, Her Majesty's Revenues and Customs, because I used to pay a monthly sum and a quarterly sum on VAT. That's all changed. And they used to send me letters with a pay slip, and I used to love writing out the cheque because I knew exactly where I was. And, I'd put the amount on the stub and then weeks later I could look back and make sure I'd paid it and all that kind of stuff. No, it's all electronic now. Cheque books will be out of fashion in a few days' time.
Yeah, we've got to move with the times, Mike. Yeah, you know, this is the way it is.
I totally agree. Now, you tell me, come on, if you had a child and called it Wilfred, wouldn't that be a crime against childhood?
This really takes me back to when my two younger children were born.
Yeah.
My ex-husband had very strong views about what they should be called.
Right.
So each pregnancy was increasingly stressful when we were going through all the options of what the names would be.
Yes.
He was insisting that my son, Henry, as he is now known, would be called Ramesses.
Right.
Well, he was a big fan of Egyptology and had his grandfather, in fact, had been the microbiologist who'd gone into the tomb with Howard Carter in 1926. So he wanted to... Say again?
Tutankhamun.
Tutankhamun's tomb.
Wow.
So he had a great fondness for Egyptology, and he wanted to reflect that in the family. Mm. But I said, look, you can't call a kid Ramesses. He'll be known as Rambo in the playground. It'll follow him around for life. Then when my youngest daughter came along, he wanted to name her after the first female pharaoh, Hatshepsut. I said, you know, this is ridiculous. Yeah. So we argued about that for months and months. Yeah. And then in the end, we were driving to St. Bride's, the journalist church, one Sunday morning, and still arguing about it. And I said, oh, for goodness sake, just name her after the church. Mm. And he stopped speaking and he said, Bridie, I rather like that.
Great.
And of course, I had said it as a joke.
Yeah.
I had in mind Bridie from Brideshead Revisited, the great Evelyn Waugh novel.
Yeah.
You know, but it's a beautiful name and it really suits her. So I think little Wilfred, look, he's named after both his granddads.
Yeah.
I think that's lovely. He'll obviously be known as Fred or Freddie. Yeah. He won't be called Wilfred. And I think it's rather lovely.
He's known as Wilf. And
he might, but what's wrong with Wilf?
Well, hang on. Do you know what immediately hit me when I saw the name Wilfred? I thought, hang on, who do I know who's a toothy, gappy, dirty old man named Wilfred?
Wilfred Pickles.
Who was the Wilfred in A Hard Day's Night? Was that Wilfred Bramble or Wilfred Pickles?
Oh, well, I'm not sure, but at least they had a choice.
But you know the guy I mean? He was
Paul
McCartney's grandfather. And he went and said, oh, he's a clean old fella, isn't he? You know, and I thought, but he looked so old and his teeth are all yellow and all that kind of stuff, you know. And I thought, God, what a terrible, terrible image. And he'll be known as Wilf. That's the problem.
Well, I don't know, but it's a lovely old name, and I'm rather fond of the revival of these lovely old names, aren't you?
Well, I am, but only if they're more sort of Victorianly poetic and romantic than Wilf. I mean, the boy's obviously going to go to Eton, so you know, Wilf at Eton amongst the the Carruthers and the Borises and all that kind of stuff. I don't think we're anyway talking about Boris Johnson, of course. I'm delighted to see that the Fleet Street hack who actually smashed it this weekend was David Wooding, a really old great of mine, a great old mate of mine. David and I did the Toxteth riots in about 1979-80 on the streets of Liverpool, because that's where David comes from. I was working for the Express in the north of England, and I've known him ever since, and a very, very hard-working guy, David. He's the political editor of The Sun on Sunday, and he got a talk in Boris Johnson's office about those critical moments in hospital when Boris actually said the surgeons and the doctors around him were talking about how they were going to break the news to Downing Street if something went badly wrong, which it could have done.
Well, we would have been on obituary duty, or obit duty, as we used to call it back then, wouldn't we?
Absolutely.
All the papers would have had the obituaries ready to run.
Yep.
And imagine being the person having to update that every day.
Yes.
And what sort of turmoil in the country would that have caused, do you think?
Enormous. There was a debate. There's been a debate on TV ever since that story broke. And, once again, and it wears me down, a load of hacks, criticising Fleet Street, it's terrible, we were misled. No, I don't agree. There are times when you tell the absolute truth. There are times when you have to be measured about how much information is released. And if we thought that the Prime Minister was on death's doorstep, what a terrible morale blow that would have been for us.
Yeah, and the options weren't exactly thrilling, were they?
Mm.
I mean, who would we have turned to?
Yeah.
I dread to think what would have happened if Michael Gove had ended up in number 10.
Yeah, I agree. And Dominic Raab, when he did his first one as stand-in leader of the country, had just been told about the severity of Boris's condition. And everybody said, oh, Raab's not up to it. Look, he looks all nervous and frightened, and it's his first appearance as leader of the country. He had just come out of a room where he'd been told Boris was critically ill. So he was shaken up and nervous, not because of the responsibility which had just landed on his shoulder. He thought he's going to lose his best friend in politics. I mean,
He should have had a double scotch before he went on. Maybe he did.
Yeah, I agree. He definitely should have done. Now then, my dear, of course, one of our favourite subjects, which we always get round to because they're good copy for us, so to speak, is old Harry and Meghan. Have you seen this book they're bringing out? It's called Finding Freedom. And apparently they've called it that because they are making the simile with Nelson Mandela's Walk to Freedom.
Well, it's mad, isn't it? But it's going to get known as Finding Nemo, isn't it? Because, you know, she's working for Disney now, cleaning up load of dosh from them. Yeah. It's becoming more Disneyfied by the day, their story. Yeah. And I just don't want to know. I'm sort of, look, you chose to jump ship. You chose to run off to America and make a new life for yourself. You wanted privacy. Go and have it. Yeah. They don't want us to read about them in the press. So I don't want to read about them in a book. Is anybody seriously going to buy this?
No, well, I think, you know, out of curiosity, they might. They might sell a few in America. But there was a big sort of preview to the book in one of our major Sunday newspapers, the Mail on Sunday, at the weekend. And I have to say, some of the detail that comes through about Meghan, you know, it says here, she's nice to her staff in the main and she was very warm towards... who's that? That's Kate. No, Meghan apparently flies into rages, shouts at the staff, humiliates them, even shouts at Kate's staff and humiliates them. What she found out apparently was that when she came to this country and they moved into Kensington Palace, and this is a book actually about Kensington Palace, they moved to Kensington Palace. They moved into an apartment next to 1A. And 1A apparently is the massive, fabulous 16-bedroom apartment where Diana used to live, OK? And it's now occupied by William and Kate. So when Harry and Meghan moved in next door to an apartment about quarter of the size, Meghan threw a right fit and said, you know, what are we doing living in this hovel? So she demanded they moved out. So that's why they ended up at Windsor in Frogmore Cottage and then decided she was living in the middle of the Kalahari Desert. And next call was going to be California.
Doesn't it beg all the questions? Why did this lady marry Harry?
Yes, it does. Yes, what was the purpose? What was her plan from the start? What did she think she was going to do? Now that she's kidnapped a member of the royal family and taken him back hostage to America, what happens next? I totally agree. And honestly, God knows where it's all going to end up. We simply don't know.
She's like the malevolent Disney princess now,
yeah,
isn't she?
There was
the witch called Maleficent, wasn't there? She's almost like Maleficent now instead of Meghan. The thing she did wrong for me, and I was championing her cause for quite a long time, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the thing she did wrong was to come out publicly and call her own father a liar.
Yes.
In the press, you do not do that.
Yeah.
You don't take your own father to court.
No.
Whoever you are, I don't care who it is, what they've done, you keep that at home, private, and you don't wash your dirty linen in public.
I totally agree. But she's lost the first part of that case. She's suing the Mail on Sunday because she says they infringed her privacy by publishing a letter which had already circulated in People magazine, of course, in America. And in the first hearing, the judge just said, there's not much foundation to this case. I don't know what she's talking about. However, that's another story. Did you ever go inside Kensington Palace?
Well, no, I didn't. But I did gate crash Princess Margaret's house once on Mystique.
Yeah.
Broke in, actually. She wasn't there at the time.
Right.
But I was staying in David Bowie's house, writing a book about Freddie Mercury.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And the housekeeper of the place had keys to various other properties around the island.
Yeah.
And he said one day, do you want to go to Princess Margaret's house?
Yeah,
yeah, we do. So we went. We hid in her wardrobes. We jumped on her beds. We behaved like absolute children. But it was great fun, I have to say.
I bet it was. I'm told that when Princess Margaret threw a party, wherever it was, whether it was Kensington Palace or Mustique or whatever, as long as she wanted to stay up and smoke and drink huge amounts of gin and tonic, everybody else stayed up. And if that was 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, nobody left before her. But again, in this book that they serialised about Kensington Palace, it says that She used to actually sing. She thought she was a singer, right? No joke.
They all think they're singers, you know, they do.
You've told me this before about people who have ambitions for their children and all that. But
this is what comes of sleeping with Mick Jagger.
Well, I suppose you're... Oh, really? Is that right?
Goodness. Oh, she did, yeah.
Did she really? What Princess?
Yeah, the whole Mystique set.
Yeah?
Yeah, you know, and she was quite a gal. Well, she liked her boys.
So there's been Rogerization between Mick Jagger and the late Princess Margaret.
Allegedly.
Allegedly, yeah, I think we've had that word. But it wouldn't surprise me on either side, obviously. But what I was going to say is that so all the time she'd sing and go on for about 12 minutes, and then at the end, you know, the whole of the room rapturously applauding her. Anyway, there was one guy there from the showbiz world. It doesn't say who it was. But when all the clapping had finished, he stood up and said, "That was appalling. Why are you all clapping? I've never heard of her." And she stormed out the room. And a few minutes later, you know, a couple of gophers came in, escorted the person out of the premises, and he never mixed in royal circles again. That's the sort of person she was. We did when I was a very young reporter, you know, on the Chester Chronicle or something. She came to like somewhere in Cheshire to open something. I think it might have been Bowater's paper factory or something like that. You know what I mean? But the Bentley pulled up, the door opened, and she literally fell. It was 2:30 in the afternoon. She fell out of the car onto the...
Oh, she was sozzled already.
Completely pissed, yeah. And, you know, yeah, and
good girl.
She was dazed and, yeah. But, I mean, that was her life. If you read of the lifestyle of Princess Margaret, you know, shortly after she died, sadly, R.I.P., her day consisted of waking up to a maid who brought in the breakfast with a packet of 20 cigarettes and the newspapers. She got up at 11, took her first drink on the side of the bath when she went into her bathroom, got down for lunch at 11, at 1 o'clock, either going out to meet friends or friends coming round to a lunch party. And that's how the day went on until she repeated the act for dinner. I mean, you feel sorry for somebody like that.
Oh, definitely. She had a very sad life, actually.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Somebody who is sister to one of the great leaders of the modern world.
Yes, indeed.
Your life is useless.
Yeah.
Her husband was not faithful. She didn't get to marry the person she fell in love with, Group Captain Townsend.
Yeah.
Nowadays, she would have been allowed.
Yeah.
And so she drank and shagged her way through her life. But she had the most horrible death.
Yeah.
She boiled herself to death in a bath.
Boiled her feet in the bath.
She didn't realize the temperature of the water and got in. It was boiling water. By the time she got out, she was, you know, on the way out.
Yeah, it was terrible. And this book, again, by the way, it's fascinating. It says that she and what was his name? Lindley, her husband.
Was Armstrong Jones.
Armstrong Jones, the photographer. It says that they actually competed with each other as to how many of their friends they could shag. You know what I mean? Just to make each other jealous.
Yeah, well, that's just boredom, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Indiscriminate, and it's horrible.
Yeah,
it's an empty way of life, and I do feel sorry for her.
Yeah, he'd screw some lady in waiting or one of their noble, entitled friends who was married to somebody else, and then she'd go and screw somebody like, you know, a private detective, you know, one of her detectives or something like that. Apparently, that's how life went, you know, all the time.
It's still going on in the royal family, mind you. You know, there's lots of rumours circulating.
Well, we won't get into that because we don't damage it. Now, talking about singers, two names I'm going to mention to you. Mary Hopkin, okay, was 70.
Lovely Mary Hopkin.
This week, yeah. And I didn't realise that after her initial burst into fame with Those Were the Days and Tears of Rain Run Down My Window Pane, I'm on my own again, Good Evening Sorrow, and songs like that written for her by the Beatles, she ended up marrying one of David Bowie's co-writers. Is that right?
No, not quite. It was Twiggy, you may remember, who saw her on Opportunity Knocks.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that programme back in the day?
Yes, I did.
And Hughie Green.
Opportunity Knocks.
Opportunity Knocks.
Yeah.
Twiggy introduced her to Paul McCartney. Mary was one of the first signings to the Beatles' Apple label.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Paul wrote Goodbye for her. She went on to... Yeah, she represented us in us in the 1970 Eurovision Song Contest, and her voice was crystal clear, so beautiful.
Yeah.
She had a song called Knock Knock Who's There?
Knock Knock Who's There?
That one.
Would it
but she came
that door
She
is
came shush.
Open wide.
He does go on. Yeah. She came second to Dana, who had the song All Kinds of Everything, which you may remember.
Of everything remained me of you.
Something like that. Yeah. But then, she did marry Tony Visconti, who was David Bowie's most loyal producer for all their fallings out over the years.
Yeah.
And she did some backing vocals for David on the Low album. Wow. So you may remember the song Sound and Vision. That's Mary's backing vocals on that.
That's a great that one. Because the lyrics only started halfway through it, didn't it? Because there was some great guitar work first. And then, Sound and Vision.
It's a very stylish song.
Yeah.
But she sang backing vocals on lots of people's albums, like Ralph McTell. In fact, Ralph McTell had an album out quite recently, and she's on that, although she doesn't perform anymore. Ooh. She no longer does live stage work. Yeah. She worked with Thin Lizzy, Elaine Page, all kinds of bands.
Yeah.
But she gave up singing full time when she had her children, who I know actually, Morgan and Jessica.
Good girl, that's amazing.
And in the end, he dumped her and he went off and married May Pang, who you remember was John Lennon's girlfriend.
Of course I do. John Lennon went off to California with her for 18 months. Yeah, that's
The Lost Weekend.
The Lost Weekend's amazing. Oh, well, that's all that's absolutely amazing stuff. And I didn't realize that she graduated to other great things. Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself and the wonderful Leslie Ann Jones. As ever, the rock chick extraordinaire, bringing incredible insight into stories that we only touch the surface of, but Leslie Ann gets down there with the kids and right into it. Another singer I want to mention to you, Leslie Ann, and she's not really a singer, and I've got nothing against her, but when I heard Amanda Holden is now putting out a single, you know, something to do with COVID-19. I thought, I think this is a sort of pandemic opportunity for a new diversion in your career, because I don't think any of us have ever known Amanda to be a singer before, have we?
Oh, yeah, she was. She was a musical theatre performer before she married Les Dennis. And I'm afraid I always said that she used Les Dennis. No, she used him as a stepping stone to a wider career because she dumped him soon enough, you know, once she was famous. But she was in musical theatre. She does all the singing and dancing and acting and all that. But I heard that single the other day. Steve Wright debuted it on his afternoon show on BBC Radio 2.
Right.
And I turned to my daughter and I went, auto-tune. Yeah. You know, you can hear it all the way through.
What's that then?
I do think that this recording of charity singles to raise money for the NHS has become a pandemic in itself.
Yes.
And I'm a bit sick of it now because Queen have put one out. You know, they are the champions. Yes. Everybody's doing it. Michael Ball did one with Captain Tom Moore, who's now Colonel Tom Moore, we know.
Right, yeah.
But I just think I've had enough of it now, you know.
Yeah,
really, I can do without Amanda Holden's Somewhere Over the Rainbow. I prefer Judy Garland.
Yeah, so do I. What's an auto-cue thing? What did you say? Auto-what?
Auto-tune is a technique in the studio when somebody's voice isn't quite up to scratch, the pitch has fallen, the tone isn't there, it might be a bit out of tune. So auto-tune is an automatic device to apply a perfect pitch and tuning to somebody's voice that is a little below par, shall we say.
Okay. Now,
I might be doing the girl a disservice, but I could hear it all over the single.
Well, you should know about these things. You listen to a lot of music. Now, I don't want to give you any sort of wild ideas as a Jan, but it's come to my attention that the pornographic industry has absolutely been driven to a halt because of the intimacy laws. You can't actually put together a porno film if you've got to stay 2 yards apart, unless, of course, you have some extraordinary sort of physical attributes. You know what I mean?
Well, thank God for that. Yeah. You know, is there really a place for a porn industry in the 21st century?
Well, this is the point, because what's happening is, because we all now have cameras and we all have methods of communication, like you and I are communicating now, apparently a huge cottage industry has grown up for couples to make their own porn films at home, you know, and film them themselves, and then they, you know, they bang them off, you know, electronically to...
Bang them off being the operative,
the operative word. Bang them off to companies, and they'll do it for as little as £25. So,
well, how shameful is that? Is that how you want to go down in history?
Exactly.
You know, I made films of myself having sex with my husband and then put it out there in the world for 25 quid so everybody else can watch it.
I'm talking about doggers and all sorts of people.
You know, it's revolting.
I know. So
really scraping the barrel. People should just get back in the wardrobe. Stop it, everybody.
I totally agree with you, and it's something we shouldn't even really raise, but I think we had to because it's of national concern. Now, listen, talking about national concern and getting a bit more serious for a minute, in this week, in 1968, the first ever heart transplant was successfully completed in this country. And that absolutely shocked me to think that was only 42 years ago. I can't believe it.
And you never got yours, did you?
I never got mine, but my father died, can you believe, of the same symptoms I've got, which is dilated cardiomyopathy, which leads to acute heart failure, which I'm still waiting to finally happen. But the dilated cardiomyopathy bit, my father had, he died of it because they hadn't diagnosed it. They didn't diagnose it because it was a condition so little was known about in those days. But do you know when my father died? And that was in about 1982. I think my dad died in 1981 or 82. The first heart transplant had never taken place. There hadn't been any heart transplants. Nobody knew what a heart transplant was, and that's when my dad died, because he had this terrible condition which floods your lungs with water because your heart's not working. They didn't diagnose it, and he literally died.
Hang on, did you not say that the first one was in 1969 or something?
No, in this country, 82. Before that, it was
Because Christian Barnard was doing it, wasn't he?
Absolutely, Christian Barnard pied it in Grootschkoor Hospital in Cape Town before that. But it was 82 in this country before the very first one. And my father died weeks before that.
I'm so sorry.
Amazing. Well, no, it's one of those things that happened. But there hadn't been one in this country up till then. But
so are you still waiting for a heart, Mike?
Well, it's too complicated to get into. I was on the heart transplant list for 7 months. I took myself off it because life had come to a standstill. And miraculously, I kind of got better. My heart recovered. I was able to live with it. But as you get older, your heart deteriorates like everything else in your body. And I was due to go in for some treatment before lockdown, which now is not going to happen. There's, you know, the space and availability, but the risk of transmitting the COVID-19 virus into a hospital where you've got some of the most vulnerable people in this country have already got critically damaged hearts is too big a risk. But not to worry about that. That will...
Yeah, but question, right?
Yeah.
So if our hearts giving out is the thing that kills us in the end...
Yes.
Theoretically, if we were able to replace our heart every few years when it was, packing up, could we live forever?
Well, you couldn't live forever because your brain would go, or your kidneys or liver, but you'd live an awful lot longer. One of the mysteries of science to me, and I spent a lot of time at Harefield Hospital, met all the doctors, my own consultant, Dr. Nicholas Banner, has retired now, but he undoubtedly got me through years and years of survival, which probably wouldn't have happened without him. And I always said to him, we used to have this conversation, that a heart is the easiest thing to replicate as a false transplant organ. Do you see what I mean? A liver has to do some very, very scientific and technical things, separating poisons from fresh water and urine and all that kind of stuff. All the heart has to do is move in and out and pump blood. And I said, surely you can make a simulated heart, i.e. I'm talking about false hearts, And I can't understand why they still haven't got a false heart to put inside somebody like me, which all it's got to do is pump blood around the body.
Well, now that we've got 3D photocopiers and people are making all kinds of stuff, surely we can make fake hearts.
I would have thought so. I'm sure. I can't believe you can't make a plastic heart. I mean, you know, we've got pacemakers. We've got people who have hips replaced. We've got people who have, you know, bones replaced by metal rods and all this kind of stuff. I can't believe that we haven't yet got a heart. I believe
have a heart. Is it that the body rejects it because it's such a vital organ? The body, some piece of plastic.
The body does, but you take all sorts of anti-rejection drugs, even when you have a new heart. You see what I mean? So a false heart, a plastic heart, shouldn't be that difficult. I mean, when I read that we're very close, and it'd be a major breakthrough to giving sight back to blind people by inventing something that plants images into the brain, I still can't believe we haven't got a plastic heart. But anyway, look, what
maybe in our lifetime. I mean, so much has happened in our lifetime, hasn't it?
Yes. Yeah, maybe in our lifetime, I hope. Now, one of the other great Fleet Street stories I was going to talk to you about, because people love talking Fleet Street, was Coo Stark.
This is your territory.
Well, it is, yeah. But did you not ever have any dealings with her?
No, not really. No, no, I wasn't in that sort of field at that time. No. But this was very much your territory.
Oh, it was. Yeah, I'd only just started the Express in London, and Prince Andrew had come back from the Falklands War a hero, and it was probably about 6 months later or something. And all of a sudden, the story broke that he was seeing this sort of soft porn actress, which he wasn't, to be honest, Coo Stark.
Whoever came up with that headline? I mean, that was damning, wasn't it?
It was, but I mean, you know, she was pictured in some frilly underwear, but I mean, she was never in a porn film or anything like that.
We never saw any of her bits, did we?
No, absolutely not. So I was told to go out to the office with a photographer called Keith Butler and don't come back until you found her. And it took 10 days. And every day, I was under the enormous pressure that if a picture of Coo Stark had appeared in any other paper, I was getting up at 5 a.m, you know, to look at all the other papers. And if anybody else had found it before me, that would have been it at the end of my career, without a shadow of a doubt. In fact, largely as a result of finding her, a year later, I was in New York for the Daily Express. But anyway, that's by the by. But we were so diligent, Keith and I, we were at it 18 hours a day, following up leads, you know, trying to track down her friends, trying to steal secrets from other newspapers by listening in on their conversations in pubs and all that kind of stuff. And eventually one night near Earl's Court, we had a tip that she would be at this particular address. We arrived and Keith hid behind the wall. A motorbike turned up at 2 a.m. It's about between 1 and 2 a.m. And a person got off the back, a slight person, and it looked like a woman. And she got off, turned towards us, and she had a motorcycle helmet on with a visor. And Keith just got up, bang, massive great flash. We only got the opportunity to take one. Then she ran off up the driveway into the house. And he said, we'll have to see what we've got. And when we got back to the office and developed it, the flash had gone right through the visor, the black visor, and there was a picture of Coo Stark, first picture ever. So,
wow.
So we got it. And we put it into the Fleet Street edition that night. You know, in those days, we still had papers going out at 3 a.m, you know. And then, of course, we put it all over the world the following day. But
great scoop.
It was a great scoop, but it was very, very hard work. On the way to that, in the 10 days, I picked up another story about how she and Prince Andrew and some friends in a basement flat in, Belgravia, that's right, funnily enough, Belgravia, had been taking videos of each other. And I got that from the Spanish...
Well, they weren't doing porn videos, were they?
They weren't doing porn videos, no. But nevertheless, they were doing videos, and the Spanish cleaner told me that when I saw her coming out the house one day, and she didn't know what she was telling me. You know, she didn't realise we were looking for Coo Stark. She said, oh, you mean the girl who did the films? And I said, what? You know, and then she told us about it. And in fact, we got a splash out of that because Scotland Yard and Special Branch feared that those videos would be stolen, and they swooped on the house the next day and took them all away. But anyway, the point of my story is I got a lot of stick off our listeners when I started mentioning Coo Stark. I put it out in a tweet because it was her birthday recently, and accused of stalking women. But I mean, that's not stalking, is it?
Well, is it? I think back in the day, Mike, when we were doorstepping people, because that's what we did for a living and we were required to do that.
Yeah.
I feel quite shabby about some of that now, by the way.
We have
different views on how we treat women in society nowadays. And I think probably she could have brought an action against you. Yeah. And against your photographer for having stalked her, just for the fact that she was a woman, not to do with the fact of who she was and who she was dating.
Yeah.
So I think you'd have to think really seriously twice about doing something like that now.
Mm. Maybe, but I've always believed in the adage that what appears in a newspaper is driven by what the readers want to see. You know, the hypocrisy of newspaper readers over the years, oh, newspapers are scum. Oh, really? Is that why you rush out to buy one when the latest scandal about, you know, somebody very famous appears and everybody's talking about it? And the worst offenders, of course, are the what you'd call the broadsheet papers, you know, the titles that I'm talking about, who always condemn the so-called tabloids, although I don't think you could describe the Daily Mail as a tabloid newspaper, and what they do is they report on the very same stories by condemning the papers that have done it and summing up what they've done. It's outrageous.
Yeah, well, it is. But, you know, the rules have changed and we have to move with the times.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Were you ever a fan, by the way, of the... I know you're not a great fan of TV anyway, but in a professional way, did you ever get involved in Sex in the City?
Well, not really. I was kind of past that by then.
Yeah.
I was out of Fleet Street, so I never got to interview any of those actresses.
Yeah.
Although... I obviously was aware because my elder daughter was very into the series.
Right, okay.
I have met Candace Bushnell, who wrote... She used to write a column on the New York Observer.
Right.
And she turned her own single life as a single girl in New York into some novels. And then they eventually became the series Sex and the City.
Oh, really? Is that where it all came from? Because I could never understand the point of it. I tried to watch it a few times, watched the first 20 minutes, and I thought, what is the fucking, excuse my language, what is the point of this, you know, this series? I don't...
Well, it wasn't for you, was it? It was for women. It was one of those series that was made for women, and it was intended to demonstrate female liberation and the fact that women can be out there and living a city life.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, the bottom line thing that they want is love, because it's what we all want. It's the universal thing.
Yeah.
But the idea was that they could have active sex lives and behave just as openly as men would. Now, Candace Bushnell, the author and the creator of the series, she's got a new book out, which is why she's in the press.
Right.
And the new book is Rules for Being a Girl. It's aimed at much younger women, and it's fueled by the Me Too movement. And it's to try and help girls understand inappropriate male behavior and how they should behave in the modern world.
Right.
And I think she's done a really good thing there. She's got a sad life, really. She's talking about not having had sex for 5 years.
Yeah.
She also said that her husband, who she was very madly in love with and was very happy with, was pursued, was stalked by a 23-year-old girl, and that girl has now stolen her husband.
Yeah.
It's very sad.
Yeah, well, you know, you say it's very sad, but she's had a remarkable life. You know, she's been a great writer and she's created one of the legendary TV series of all times. That takes a toll, doesn't it? When you
It does, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I mean. You know.
She's 61 now.
Yeah.
She's lost her husband to a much younger woman. She doesn't have any children.
Yeah.
And she doesn't have, you know, that life now, because Sex and the City, that we've moved on from that now.
Yeah.
We have a different society now. And that series coming up now would never get airtime.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be appropriate anymore.
One clip I saw when I switched it on once to try and find out what it was all about was one of the women. Did they all share a flat or something?
No, they lived separately, but they were, you know, four girlfriends
who
sort of shared their lives and had lunch all the time and stuff.
And one of them went
and bought shoes.
Bought shoes, that's right. Yeah, one of them went to a gym and is doing a few press-ups and all that when she spots a bloke who's, you know, she thinks is very cute and rather shapely, and goes up to him and asks him if he'd like to have sex in the changing room. And he says, yeah, that'd be great. And I was absolutely shocked. You know what I mean? I'm quite a prude, really, when it comes to relationships like that. And she'd never met a guy before in her life. I mean, I find that...
That was Kim Cattrall. And the character she played was called Samantha Jones, which is the name of my sister. So it was always quite uncomfortable to watch her. The one I remember, I can't get this image out of my head, was she was shagging a fireman up against a fire engine. And she was completely stark naked. Looked really good, by the way. But, you know, even so.
Shocking behaviour.
Isn't it?
You're talking about TV series. Maybe there is one that came into your era as rock chick writer, although it wasn't very rock chick. But Gladiators, they're thinking of bringing it back, I've read this morning.
Oh, please not. Let's not go there again.
Exactly, you know. And John Fashanu apparently is the guy who's pushing the agenda on this one. Well, I suppose, I think that probably means that Mr. Fashanu, who I know quite well, actually, from his football connections, probably hasn't got a lot to do at the moment if he wants to bring back Gladiators.
Well, they can't make it right now, can they? Because you can't have people in close contact with each other.
No,
so
I think
they'll have to wait a while, I think.
They're talking about when it all comes back together, you know. The other interesting thing that I've picked up on is I've never been a huge Neil Diamond fan. I respect him for the success he's had, and I liked one or two of his songs, but thought the others were a bit mushy. He wants to make a comeback and bring out a new LP at 79. Is that a good idea?
Well, let's give Neil a break, shall we? I grew up on Neil Diamond records. My father was a massive fan. He knew him in America. I think very few people know that he backed out from the industry a while ago because he has Parkinson's disease.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But in the early days of his career, did you know that he was one of the major songwriters in the Brill Building in New York, which is where Carole King and Jerry Goffin and Cynthia Vile and all those great writers came up with all the fantastic pop hits of the 60s? It was like a hit factory. Neil Diamond wrote for the Monkees, I'm a Believer, A Little Bit Me, A Little Bit You.
That's the thing.
So I sold out all the Love to Love, all those great songs. And Elvis recorded his songs, Deep Purple, Lulu, Cliff, Barbara Streisand. You know, so he wasn't just a one-man band, if you get what I'm saying.
I
think he's amazing. I've seen him live several times. I took my mum and dad. That was a great moment for me to do that. And he's having a resurgence in popularity.
Yeah.
Now, you may have seen on Twitter, I don't know if you have, you know, he had that song, Hands... touching hands, reaching out, touching me, touching you. I think it's Sweet Caroline. Sweet Caroline is the song.
Caroline.
So he did a version of it. Hands, washing hands, not touching you, not touching me for the coronavirus crisis. So, you know, this, I think, has given him a resurgence. And look, he's 79. What kind of comeback is he really going to have?
Yeah.
He's not going to go on the road. But I love his albums. I play them frequently, especially the Christmas albums.
Yeah.
And I think give him a break.
Yeah.
You know, give him another listen. I think you might hear him differently now.
I like bits of his songs. I like that one about LA's fine, the sun shines most of the time. And then LA's home.
I am, I said. That is the song.
Yeah, LA's fine, but it ain't mine. New York's mine, but it ain't home no more.
What kind of lyrics? Amazing lyricist, that guy.
Just to conclude, and it's been an absolute joy to work with you again today, Leslie. And thank you very much indeed. Depth of your knowledge.
Thank you, Mike.
Time shocks even me. But the one thing you said there, which really struck home with me, was Neil Diamond and the Monkees. I really loved the Monkees in the 60s. I was a kid. You know, I missed Beatlemania as a teenager by about 4 years. And similarly with the Monkees. And I thought they were great songs. And I thought these guys are really talented. But what happened to the Monkees, apparently, you'll know better than me, that you're absolutely right. Neil Diamond and other great songwriters wrote all the songs for them. And
they didn't play their instruments.
And they didn't play their own instruments. It was session.
Well, one of them did.
But then they started to believe their own publicity and demanded of the guys who put the band together, we want to write our own songs now. We want to play our own instruments. What happened?
Exactly. But they had their moment, didn't they?
They did have their moments.
I went to see Davy Jones at the Albert Hall a few years ago, and it was about 2 weeks before he died. It was really sad because he was, you know, he's a little dwarf kind of guy, but he still had all the energy and all the banter, and it was fantastic to see him again.
Yeah.
And then he died out of the blue. It was such a shame.
Last thing I can tell you is that as I'm speaking to you now, looking at my record collection on the wall opposite, CDs, I have a Monkees Greatest Hits. And
there you are. Pull that one down. You can dance around the room when we're done.
I was about to say, I might even pull it out now for those memories of the...
He means the CD, ladies and gentlemen.
I mean the CD, that's right. Young people won't order CDs, but we've got them. Leslie Ann, once again, thank you very much indeed for being with me today. Remind me, please, of the address where people can write to us, the Gmail address. In fact, it is... planetporkypod@gmail.com. Is that correct?
That's the one.
That's right.
And on Twitter, you are?
I am Mike Parry 8, and you are?
@LAJWriter.
Excellent. And that was my phone buzzing because somebody else is trying to get hold of me. So out of the studio and onto the blower. Leslie Ann, as ever, stay safe and we'll talk again soon.
Ciao.
To actually sing, she thought she was a singer, right? No joke.
All think they're singers, you know, they do.
You told me this before about people who have ambitions for their children and all that. But
this is what comes of sleeping with Mick Jagger.
Well, I suppose you. Oh, really? Is that right?
Oh, she did, yeah.
Did she really? What princess?
Yeah, the whole Mystique set.
Yeah.
And she was quite a gal.
Well,
she liked her boys.
So there's been Rogerization between Mick Jagger and the late Princess Margaret.
Allegedly.
Allegedly, yeah, I think we've had that word. But it wouldn't surprise me on either side, obviously. Apparently, a huge cottage industry has grown up for couples to make their own porn films at home, you know, and film them themselves, and then they bang them off, you know, electronically to...
Bang them off being the operative. Yeah.
The operative word. Bang them off to companies and they'll do it for as little as £25. So,
how shameful is that? Is that how you want to go down in history?
Exactly.
You know, I made films of myself having sex with my husband and then put it out there in the world for 25 quid so everybody else can watch it.
I'm talking about doggers and all sorts of people.
Oh, it's revolting. That one.
But she came. The door she is came.
Shush.
Open wide.
He does go on. Yeah. She came second to Dana, who had the song All Kinds of Everything, which you may remember.
Of everything remained me of you.
Something like that.